all of this together shaped how I began to think about mind, not as something to be mastered, but as a landscape of the unspoken, whether it were ghosts or griefs or desires that were hard to relinquish. So I saw that the ghost was not always another. It was often intimate, tied to lost ones, sometimes to unmet desires, to unbearable longings. But in some ways, possession was an attempt to keep close what was slipping away. And the ghost doesn't just haunt, like I said in the beginning. It felt as if it wants something, and we just have to learn to develop ears to listen to what it wants.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Shalini Masi. Dr. Masi is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist who trained at Tavistock in Portland, where she has a master's degree in psychoanalytic studies and a PhD from the University of Delhi. And our conversation today focuses around her recent book entitled Psychoanalytic Conversations with States of Spirit Possession, Beauty in Brokenness. Now, this is an unusual conversation. Clinicians and analysts, at least in the West, don't generally have conversations about ghosts outside of the more familiar characterizations of dissociative identity disorder, or, of course, borrowing from Lowell's well-known concept of ghosts turning into ancestors, which we borrow as a title for the podcast. And the beginning discusses the similarities and differences between her work and his work. What's important about her work is it is really a description of her own evolution as a clinician, whereas her early temptations in the face of these frankly strange and disturbing phenomena, that is, individuals who live terrorized at times by ghosts, though not only, and her inclination was to interpret these based on theory or her anxiety. And her journey describes how she became able to evolve and to open herself and, as she beautifully describes it, to discover the landscape of the unspoken. And she uses as a model her grandmother, who she said had a fearless love in the face of these terrors of the ghosts. And she shares with us her family background, which was one that she was very familiar with ghosts and exorcisms. The patient lets her know what it's like to live in this very uncomfortable place, which is a confluence of internal conflicts and cultural forces. We cover the territory about her own journey, as I say, the patient's struggles with her, and what it meant for her to, as she says, to sit and witness this patient's experiences in order to have it be representationable. And that's the similarity I find with Lowell, that the end result is to have a representation is the essence of his version of turning it into ancestors. There's much more to be said. I found it fascinating and delightful. And as always, I learned something, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Shalini, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you. Shalini, you have written a challenging work. To repeat, the title of the book is Psychoanalytic Conversations with States of Spirit Possession, Beauty in Brokenness. And spirit possession isn't the usual language that most clinicians, certainly most Western clinicians, are familiar with. And reading the work poses challenges that we're going to discuss together today to understand the core issues that are common in your work, common in the Western way of thinking. And we also will get to your own development as a clinician, which this book, I think, it's practically a diary of, as I read it. But I want to start by discussing the title about ghosts and ancestors. Many of our listeners will be familiar with that phrase. It is from a classic paper by Hans Lowold in 1960, and it's called On the Therapeutic Action of Psychoanalysis, and he coined that phrase. And I borrowed that phrase to introduce your work and to also make a bridge from your work to familiar work, but I want to acknowledge similarities and differences. And let me just read a couple of sentences from that paper of his. He writes, "The transference neurosis, in the technical sense of the establishment and resolution of it in the analytic process, is due to the blood of recognition which the patient's unconscious is given to taste, so that the old ghosts may reawaken to life. Those who know ghosts tell us that they long to be released from their ghost life and led to rest as ancestors. As ancestors, they live forth in the present generation, while as ghosts, they are compelled to haunt the present generation with their shadow life." Now, importantly, his notion of ghosts is one of a metaphoric representation to try to characterize the images and imaginings in our unconscious, which we are not aware of. And through providing a medium of awakening, the transference, the analyst and discovers those ghosts. Mm-hmm. Now, the people you spend time with in this book, that doesn't capture what they mean by ghosts. They mean ghosts qua ghosts, like sort of in the movies where there's a ghost doing something, there's a ghost taking over them. So in that sense, the characterizations of ghosts are quite different. So when I thought of this, I asked myself, well, by what poetic license or how much stretch am I giving to this poetic license, to borrow his phrase, for our work and your book? And it seemed to me that what you have in common is the notion of ancestors, and that is that you're both sort of reaching for the same possibility. He writes, "In the daylight of analysis, the ghosts of the unconscious are laid to rest and led to become ancestors, whose power is taken over and transformed into the newer intensity of present life, of the secondary process and contemporary objects." That is, the affects, the imaginings, the impulses, the fears that are previously externalized and concretized in your patient's ghosts, you want the same thing. You want them to own it and to live it and not have it inhibit their life and allow it to provide freedom. So on the basis of that similarity, I sort of borrowed his phrase for our work with those caveats. And before we jump into your work, I also want to mention something that you bring up in the book, which is the similarity of these, quote, ghosts with dissociative identity disorder, DID, formerly known multiple personality disorder, with alters. Your description of people engaging or experiencing or suffering with ghosts is almost identical to what people with multiple personality describe in their alters. And you mentioned at least two commonalities between the two descriptions, that they both have suffered from terrible childhood trauma and also share the sense that there was no one to help them with that trauma. And those two characterizations are true both for those of yours, your individuals who call it ghosts, and those that we're more familiarly, we call it alters. But for today, we're going to use your language. And before I ask you to tell us what you mean and what these people you're working with mean by ghosts, I want to read the first paragraph from your introduction. You write, "Is it fact or is it fiction?" At the very start, I would like to request the reader to abandon the above question. I hope you can join me by positioning yourself in the paradox that Winnicott made us aware of when he wrote that, to a child immersed in a play with transitional objects, it seems redundant to ask whether he created the object or found the object. It is the space of play that allows this paradox to remain unresolved while continuing to fuel a quality of fiction, the same quality that makes it possible to dream in psychoanalytic encounters. Minus this fictional element, the conversation becomes saturated with fact, lacking ventilation for reveries. And this is undesirable, for experiences render itself accessible to our mind through reverie. Sean, you want to start us off? Tell us about ghosts.
Hi, Arvi. Thank you for having me and giving me this opportunity to talk about my work. Thank you for also bringing in Leo Wolf's paper. I think I do see how it will help in making this work more relatable to the audience that are not familiar or might find it too strange a phenomena. While Leo Wolf's insights, as I understand it, are pertaining to, you know, how trauma or ghosts of ancestors, how they are transmitted from one generation to other. And that deeply resonates with my own engagement with possession, where individuals become, like you said, taken over or inhabited by forces, and that are both internal and external, personal and cultural. However, I would say my work diverges in its specific focus on possession as a lived experience. You know, later I would also talk about how that became my main focus, the emotional, what is the experience of being possessed? Not just, so possession in my work was not just a metaphor for some sort of a unconscious inheritance, but as a tangible, visceral phenomena that individuals struggle with in real time. So I would say my work is, I hope it's deeply immersed in cultural, religious context, but especially in the, it is in the, embedded in the Indian context. Now, you asked what tell us about ghosts. In my research, I found that ghosts are not just inherited, but they are actively engaged with in these traditional healing practices. In fact, my inspiration was the work of Sudhir Kakkar in 1980s. He wrote this book called Shamans, Mystics, and Doctors. But there his focus was more to engage with the healing practices. And I was inspired by that work, but my focus was on engaging more with the possessed people and how they transform. So the ghosts that they are inhabited with, my research participants are inhabited with, they are not always past figures haunting the present. Sometimes they are very dynamic forces that the individuals negotiate with, and they attempt to befriend or even transform through various ritualistic practices. So in that sense, my work brings a different perspective, you know, one that sees possession not just as haunting, but as a process of meaning making and transformation.
You've underlined the very challenge that I and the listener and the reader of your book will face based on what you just said. You conceive, and tell me if I have this right, you conceive, or they conceive, or both, of these ghosts as entities that need to be negotiated with, as opposed to necessary creations of their mind to cope with very difficult internal states within a cultural context. Am I noticing a difference accurately?
I don't see the difference. Like, for instance, if you take Ria's case, for instance, the longest
which
case
we're going to spend time on. Yes.
Yeah, right. We will spend time. Uh-huh. I think what I would say is that the ghosts that I engaged with, sometimes it felt like they were dynamic forces that people were tormented by and trying to negotiate with. And at other times, it felt that these were creative forces. So I would say that the ghost functioned a dual function. It was both a tormentor as well as enabler in some ways. It gave voice to the people, but also tortured them. So it served a dual function. And I approached them as lived realities, forces that they haunt, they speak, they impose, but sometimes they even guide. So they do, I would say they exist at the cusp of personal suffering and cultural idioms of distress.
I'm smiling because what you just said is almost an exact description of what can be called here in the West a compromise formation. That is, it has multiple elements. And to call it simply one is to miss what else it is. It's always all of the above. The clinical question is always what is most on the surface now to address, but one, like you say beautifully, has to recognize that to consider just one thing is to miss more than you get. Now, I want to mention what you mention in the book, which is that you have a childhood embedded in this. Let me read what you wrote. You say, "Since my childhood, I have witnessed many exorcism rituals in my household. I watched in awe when healers laid their hands on and prayed for the ailing persons and commanded the evil inhabiting spirits to leave. Although mesmerized, I also became curious. I would ask myself a series of questions. Is this real? How do their bodies feel? How can their bodies acquire such capacities? How can a ritual that seems so violent heal a person, transform them in a way that is reflected in the health of their relationships and interactions?" Tell us about this aspect of growing up.
Thank you. Thank you for picking this up. I think this is very special. It brings a different element to my research. I think it captures really the origins of my curiosity about possession and healing. Like you read, growing up in a household where my grandfather was gifted with had a gift of healing. So these are not rituals I witnessed, but not just stories, but lived experiences. And I saw them. I saw very close people being possessed and then transforming right before my eyes. So I remember, you know, that I, as a child, think of a like 5-year-old kid watching all of this. I was constantly oscillating between fascination and skepticism. On the one hand, I witnessed transformations that were undeniable. People who came seeking help in states of turmoil, whose bodies carried the weight of something unseen, and who left seemingly lighter. You know, if I borrow the phrase from Leopold, I would say that when they would be healed, their skin had color. The blood was running in their skin after mm-hmm. they would be transformed. But on the other hand, I couldn't help but ask myself, what is really happening here? You know, what is being healed and how? And these questions stayed with me and went on to become part of my driving force of my mm-hmm. research.
Sure.
Now, yeah. So I wasn't just interested in understanding it, but drawn to the experience of it. So the questions I asked are, what it is like to be taken over, what is it like to be exorcised, what to be relieved of something invisible but powerful.
This tension between experiencing and understanding is not only the nature of your journey, the nature of life, and certainly the nature of clinical work. When you had related what you just did to me in our earlier conversation, and I shared this with you, I was so struck by a similarity in a conversation I had with someone else I had interviewed on a different podcast platform. And he too was brought up in a home where his father was a religious leader. And people in the community would come to him for guidance. And he, as a young boy, witnessed, as you described, not exorcisms, but conversations of various sorts that led the people who came to his father to leave lighter, perhaps with a different color, but in better state of mind. And he, like you, was fascinated by that. And what he then became, fascinatingly, a very internationally recognized researcher on the placebo effect, which perhaps underlies much of the spirit world, the analytic world. It's hard to know which language is closer to the bone, but the similarity is so notable. But what you did is you took that experience, and let me read what, for me, signals what you did. You write, perhaps in the phenomena of possession by a ghost lies the desire to possess. Let me read that again, because it's a key point and throughout thinking and in the whole book. In the phenomena of possession by a ghost lies the desire to possess. I wonder if this projected possessiveness comes from love that is hard to relinquish. In some moments, both possession and love appear fixed. And you go on to say, the haunting appears to be a longing to belong to the haunted. Gradually, these grotesque ghosts, the haunting parts of the self, begin to emerge as the longing parts of self. Now, for me, this announces that you've decided, in small letters, to take this challenging phenomena that you were exposed to as a child and study how the mind works. Because when you come up with the phenomena of possession by ghosts lies in the desire to possess, you're in the world of dynamic thinking. And I think only dynamic thinking. I'm not aware of other thinking that captures that as succinctly as you do throughout the book. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Yes, I would say that I became interested in not exiling or exorcising or even understanding, but engaging with the phenomena. So what you just read, it captures that possession, well, not just about being taken over, but about something very human. These ghosts were very human parts for, became very human parts for me, and the more time I spent with possessed people. And it was not about holding on to some, it was about holding on to something that was, that could not be held, that was never held. So I haven't mentioned my grandmother's presence since you mentioned my childhood. Now, she was someone whose presence and whose intuitive curiosity shaped how I think about mine. She was also my playmate in most of the time when I was little. And there was something very fascinating about her. We heard stories about her fearless warmth towards ghosts. You know, she would talk to them, sometimes even relay messages. And I was very fascinated about that kind of a fearless love, that kind of empathy that saw beyond the terror. So I would say that all of this together shaped how I began to think about mind, not as something to be mastered, but as a landscape of the unspoken, whether it were ghosts or griefs or desires that were hard to relinquish. So I saw that the ghost was not always another. It was often intimate, tied to lost ones, sometimes to unmet desires, to unbearable longings. But in some ways, possession was an attempt to keep close what was slipping away. And the ghost doesn't just haunt, like I said in the beginning. It felt as if it wants something, and we just have to learn to develop ears to listen to what it wants. Is it recognition? Or is it connection? Is it belonging? So sometimes the possessed person unconsciously wants to be taken over. There were those narratives as well, where, you know, there is also a desire to merge, to avoid the pain of separation, which we'll talk more when we talk about Rhea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I must say that however connected I am to the word and concept of compromise formation, your phrasing of the landscape of the unspoken has much more poetry to it. So I may borrow that from you. Thank you. We can't omit cultural factors, obviously. And it's throughout the book. And let me just introduce it by reading. You write, the symptom of the psyche is replaced by a symbol from the culture, which subsequently assumes a public existence as a cultural symbol. in that the internal experience is staged or performed in a way that allows it to become part of the world of culturally sanctioned meaning. And when I read this, I, of course, thought about Charcot and his hysterics, who certainly staged and performed in a way that allowed it to become part of the culturally sanctioned meanings of the time. You go on to share with us the cultural challenges that you had, and you write as follows later on. My training in psychoanalysis had taught me to speak in the language of past traumas, repressed wishes and desires, loss, mourning, etc. However, in the sites that I would be visiting, the language spoken was one of myths and fables. As a Christian in a predominantly Hindu country, I often felt that Christianity was viewed as Western. I wondered about entering these cultural spaces wearing my identity, a Christian studying a discipline like psychoanalysis, whose theories are primarily anchored in the Western mind. It remained to be seen whether my status as a Christian would serve to enhance or shrink the suspicion at these cultural sites of healing. Give us some background about what it was like, especially in this context, as a Christian in a predominantly Hindu country.
You know, it's very interesting. It seems these days I'm thinking a lot about non-duality or about holding the two together without resolving them. And it seems our conversation is, for at least for my mind, becoming a lot about that. What you read initially brought to mind how this phenomena is deeply personal as well as deeply cultural, and we can't really relegate it to one only. And what you just read about my being a Christian and in a predominantly Hindu country is something I'm thinking about quite a lot these days. The passage that you read, and I've also written another paper on my experience of being a Christian in a predominantly Hindu India. I write a paper about it elsewhere. But I would say that, so my being a Christian, being a minority in a Hindu India was a very interesting experience, because although I was in my Christian upbringing, there were a lot of spiritual elements that I received. I was raised with the persona, thinking about Jesus Christ, for instance, as a persona who had this radical self-emptying love. And I used to be, as a kid, fascinated by the idea that he was almost drawn to the broken. He was drawn to the broken in the society. He was drawn to the othered. He was drawn to tax collectors, criminals, sex workers. So there was something very radical about his compassion. That was the idea of Christ that I grew up with. But the social experience of being a Christian in a Hindu country meant to be a vessel for many prejudice, notions that became popular in Indian culture through films, through how Christians were depicted in the films and in the popular media. I would have questions like, does your mom wear skirts, or do you have wine during dinner, or you only are drawn to English songs? And it was very disorienting, I remember, because we dressed and ate what everybody else ate and how they dressed. So to exist between these two worlds felt like a kind of haunting, like an echoes of conflicting hymns and conflicting ancestral voices. And later it became, spiritual and psychoanalytic frameworks that don't always align. But instead of seeing this as fragmentation, although I did have a time where I did feel fragmented by this, I think I also grew to understand it as what I'm calling some sort of a sacred hybridity, a space where multiple truths can coexist without demanding resolution. So when I have that experience of myself, I approach the possessed persons from that stance, that there are other parts in their inner world, and these other outcast parts can coexist with other more tamed parts.
And in fact, it helps me, because a clear undercurrent in the book that is just hinted at, but clearly present, is how important your religion is to you, and that your work is an expression of faith. And you just explained it more fully, and thank you for that. You know, it's funny, there are ways, you're now living in England, you're not in India, and you've been there for how long?
I've been here for 3 years now.
Because there are many things that you will refer to my ear strike me as not Western, at least not American. You combined tax collector and sex worker, and to represent those the common, the dirty, the foul, the unliked, that. And in the States, everybody has feelings about paying taxes, but one would never put the tax collector in that grouping. And I gather. That one would in India, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's introduce Rhea, because that's, aside from yourself, that is the main person you write about in the book. And I'm going to ask you to describe her, but I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and describe an exchange the two of you had to introduce where you are. And she says to you, "When in a possessed state, I feel that my body has become very heavy, that someone else is seated inside me, as if the body is mine, but the voice is someone else's." And you say to her, "Are you able to control that voice?" Now, you reflect upon your comment and that exchange in saying the following: "In hindsight, this question seemed to have stemmed from my own anxieties and fears around ghosts. I found it difficult to imagine a body and voice that were not mine. My fears ensued from an apprehension of the lack of agency over oneself that Rhea was inviting me to empathize with and experience. My anxiety was also a revelation that I was by this time sufficiently in tune with Rhea's states. I too felt as scared as she was. Perhaps she too could intuitively sense my fear, because subsequently she began to probe me about my professional convictions. Rhea asks you, 'So do you believe in ghosts?'" Now, if one would pause at this moment, one could have a whole panel discussion among analysts about that exchange and this moment and how to engage that question, "So do you believe in ghosts?" What you write about it is a clinical stance on my part would enhance, a clinical stance meaning not answering the question, would enhance her sense of estrangement, so she wanted to make sure that I shared her beliefs and was not looking at her as pathologically ill. Your response was, "I don't know. I'm still figuring it out. There is something there." So introduce Rhea to us.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. I think at this point, I would also, before I introduce her, what comes to my mind is something you said when we initially spoke, that how this work was about, became about honoring the immediacy of experience. So what the exchange that you read does show me reflecting on, you know, some error, and this book is full of them. And that's how probably I show the evolution of myself, not just as a researcher.
By the way, don't misunderstand my comment as in any way suggesting I think your answer was an error. I'm not thinking of correct or incorrect.
Now, when I first met Rhea, I think it would be better to say that she noticed me. She came and she found me before I found her. It was quite challenging, and she described possession not as a metaphor, as you've seen, but as a fully lived bodily reality, like a feeling of someone seated inside her, a voice that was hers yet not hers, a body that was heavy with the presence she could not control. What made her case striking was the emotional reciprocity in our conversations. She was not just narrating her experience, but I felt often that she was watching me watch her. You know, she was intuiting my anxieties, mm-hmm. questioning my stance. When she asked, "Do you believe in ghosts?" It was not a casual question. I felt she was testing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, she was testing the space between us, trying to gauge whether I saw her as someone suffering from pathology or someone having an experience that could not yet be fully explained. And in that moment, I knew, like I said, that a clinical or theoretical response would break something delicate in our exchange. So I told her the truth. I don't know. Because that was where I really stood. I did not stand in certainty. But
you took your truth and used it in the clinical moment to meet the patient where you thought she needed to be met.
Exactly. So I would say I was not in certainty, but in encounter. I think, yeah, that's very well put, actually, Harvey. And that was enough, I felt. It allowed the conversation to continue. It allowed her experience to exist without needing to be proven or dismissed. And that, for me, is the essence of how I approach this work. Not to resolve the ghost, but to listen to what it is asking of us.
And that comes across loud and clear throughout the book. One of the challenges that you invite us to share is the difficulty that we all have, ghost or not, in working with people who experience things in a literal external way to the exclusion of a simultaneous awareness of their insides. And just a brief example of this is that you make clear that this is not a person who is able to, often not able to, own her own angers and desires. And as we will read, that there are examples of that. And you two have an exchange where you say to her, is there someone who admires Rhea? That's her name. And she says, in response, she says, you mean a boyfriend?
Mm.
And then sarcastically, she says, yeah, Papa would break my legs. Now, this is one of those challenging moments that we've all been in. We all know in ourselves, and we all know clinically, that the clinician needs to be in two places at once, whereas it is certainly possible that Papa would break her leg if, in fact, she had a boyfriend. And that is maybe a literal reality that we need to know about and understand what that's like for her. And at the same time, we also need to consider the simultaneous possibility that she herself has conflict over wanting a boyfriend, and that she internally inhibits herself from knowing that by using the voice of Papa, just like she uses the voice of her ghost, to smack herself down. And for the clinician to be able to be in both places at once, which we do at best imperfectly, but the effort is what's important. And I think this case, to call it a case, we'll get to what it is or isn't, but brings that challenge to the fore.
Yes, you're right. This, you know, when I thought about possession, and this work really opened up other meanings of possession for me. It also opened up the possessiveness that we generally carry in relationships. But also, I could see how the men in her house, in Rhea's house, were making a claim on her. They were possessing her. And so she was already possessed before she entered the temple. She was possessed in her her relational equations with the male men in her house. So the moment that you read it, it reveals this deep entanglement of possession and subjecthood. And on the surface, for instance, on the surface, Rhea's fear is external, her father's threats, societal prohibitions. But strikingly, she never claims her own desires, as you also noticed. Her sexuality exists only as something controlled or forbidden, never as something she fully owns. And this is where possessing spirit steps in. It acts out what Rhea cannot. The spirit is flirtatious, it's demanding, it's mobile. It rescues her from confinement, even physically transforming her to be more appealing. So in this way, possession becomes a split-off space where desire can exist without direct ownership. So I would say it embodies impulses that are forbidden, allowing some sort of a reconciliation between longing and fear. And it enables, but there's a cost. And the cost is, again, that the cost of agency. It grants her mobility while keeping her in this paradoxical state of possession. And what emerges here is not simple affliction. It is, I think I will go back to the term we opened with. It is like a negotiation, a way of navigating what she cannot yet consciously bear. And as you read her story, it's remarkable how those relationships also in her life change. The men in her house became, her equation with them changed. They became supportive towards the end.
We can't go far into knowing Rhea without being introduced to the Sangat. Let me read what you wrote, and then I'll ask you to explain what that is. You say to her, "Do you ever feel angry at your brother for getting things for himself, but not for you?" She says, "No, I don't feel angry. I ask him jokingly. It is the Samgat who gets angry and says," and now she's imitating the spirit's seductive tone, "Why have you kept her locked inside the house? Let her get out of the house," meaning that the Samgat wants me to step out of the house. Tell us about the Samgat.
Well, Sankat is actually a Hindi word for misfortune, you know, a trouble, a minor problem or crisis. And I would say that in the Hindu healing sites, it's also treated as that. It's treated, it doesn't evoke a very violent reaction. It is a misfortune that is to be dealt with. That's the stance I observed in the healers there. So Sankat, if we stay close to Rhea's case, it's an embodied presence, a voice within her. This is according to, if I speak from Rhea's perspective, and it has its own personality. It has its own desires, even its own grievances. So what struck me most was how Sankat was deeply enmeshed with Rhea's own relational world, you know, reacting to the peculiar family dynamics, expressing frustrations that she, in her normal state, would not acknowledge as her own. And if we take this moment, for instance, Rhea insists that she's not angry at her brother, but Sankat is angry. He's the one throwing tantrum, complaining, demanding. Now, he even wants Rhea to leave the house as if to push her beyond the constraints that keep her confined. And this raises an important question. Is Sankat an intruder, or is it a part of Rhea that she cannot consciously own? In this way, Sankat, I would say, is both cultural and deeply personal expression. It allows her to externalize something internally that cannot be owned internally is externalized and finds a representation in the cultural category of ghost. And there is, throughout this, I could also get in touch with that underneath all of this was a longing for freedom, was a longing for something beyond the life that was prescribed to her. But rather than claiming these feelings as her own, she assigns them to the Sankat, allowing her distress to have a voice.
And that voice, not surprisingly, enters your relationship. Mm. You write, "Since I was traveling, I apologized for not being able to speak to her for long. However, soon after this, I was overcome by guilt. I sensed that she would take offense. My fears were confirmed when we spoke next." She said, "That day when we spoke, when you were on the train, that very night, the Sangat wreaked havoc. I fell on the bed and then kept falling repeatedly. My body was not in my control. I kept getting up and then falling again and again. I was not able to recognize anybody around me. Soon after finishing my meal, I felt dizzy and fell unconscious. This morning, soon after breakfast, the Sangat began to create trouble." Now, this is one of the early examples, though there are more, of your having what we would call a countertransference reaction. You were not available, and she had a reaction to it, and she, for whatever reason, couldn't internalize it and talk to you directly about it and feel it. So she assigned it to the Sangat. Now, when I read this, I was scratching my head because you described you were unavailable. And then I thought, well, what's the frame here? I mean, ordinarily, you have sessions, you have weekends, you have vacations. But my understanding of this is she is not your patient and you are not her therapist. And so there is no frame, dynamic or otherwise, between the two of you. It is a free-form sort of interview relationship that took place over many years. And I was confused by this. And you and I had an exchange, I'm smiling and remembering it, when I shared with you my confusion. I said, "I don't get it. Is she your patient and are you her therapist, or is she your survey interviewee? And I said to you, I said, I'm confused and I wonder if you're confused, and then perhaps even the individual, Rhea, is confused. And you paused for a moment and you looked at me and you said, with a bit of a twinkle in your eye, you said, so what's the problem with confusion? It was a great moment. And it sort of answers the question. The way I more seriously develop it is that only in a state of confusion and ambiguity could this individual allow a relationship with you to exist. So that, intentional or otherwise, you were offering her the best that she could receive from you, which is this totally ambiguous thing. Who are we? And what are we doing? But something is happening between us that can't be simply defined in the usual words of a frame. And after you said, what's the problem with confusion? I said, okay, and let's continue. Is there anything more you want to say about it, or should we just leave it there?
No, let's talk about it. Let's say more about it. It's very interesting because that moment stayed with me as well. And I often chuckled to myself while thinking fondly about it.
You and me both. Right.
Yeah. There were many moments with Rhea. There was also one where she entered the state of Peshi, right with me, right behind her. And for 1.5 hours, she swayed. And she, so I became the couch in very literal way. There was that moment. But what you read is one of the most intense moments of counter-transference I experienced with her. But I also saw that it was an expression of, you know, longing and deprivation, but also a terror of abandonment. And in that moment, I could get in touch with this child in her, the child that needed or longed for these things. And it made me acutely aware that I was not a researcher anymore. I had become an object of transference. Mm-hmm. And she was deeply invested in our connection. And to be honest, I also felt connected to her. I felt warmth towards her. In various parts of the story, you would see that, or it's also generally true in India, people address each other in relational terms. So if you meet a stranger, like Rhea met me, I was Didi. And Didi in Hindi means older sister. And in many ways, it feels the relationship, in the relationship, I felt she was also seeing me like one, like an older sister. So I could see how even my momentary absence was felt as a rupture beyond repair. What became increasingly clear was that Sankat was also an embodiment of some kind of an attachment trauma. That the rage she felt was deeply human, and it mirrored, like I said, a little child's panic when love has been fragile and connections have been fragile or conditional or taken away. So her regression wasn't acting out of an unmet need, an attempt to restore something, restore a connection through disruption. That's how I saw it. And it's interesting that we are talking about this, because yesterday I was presenting my work elsewhere, and there's a moment that sort of clicked in my mind, which it didn't in the book, which is that she would often tell me about how she speaks to me and I listen. And I also say it in the work on various occasions about how I learned to listen and to listen to myself listening. And in her journey of possession towards the end, she turns into her Sankat, turns into a Duta, a messenger of God. And this is a very rare phenomenon in Balaji. Not all possessions lead to this kind of a transformation. Now, yesterday it hit me two things. One, when she said the Sankat turns into a Duta, she described that, you know, now it listens. The Duta listens, just the way I was listening to her. And towards the end of our relationship, she says, you know, you've helped me a lot. I feel you are the Duta, the Dut that God sent to help me. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of a way in which she's internalized the function. Yeah, me as a function.
I don't think you should wonder. I think it's perfectly clear that in the marvelously helpful identification with you, she was able to feel listened to with a benevolence that which was likely new in her life. Let me ask you to read, to close out the case, in quotes, on page 187 about your relationship today.
Yes. Today, Rhea and I share a special friendship. Although she felt aided by my interventions, which were more like prayers recited in a state of anxiety, I shall always be grateful to her for teaching me some important lessons, to receive the inchoate and horrific, for instance, in dreaming, to contain the brokenness and not interpret it away, to wait until the other develops the relevant capacities, to be sensitive to my own psychic and bodily states, to appreciate the glimpses of beauty in most grotesque parts of self, and to do all of this with faith.
Again, beautifully said. And that leads us back to what I referred to at the beginning, that I see this book as practically a diary of your growth, which we are all doing, mm-hmm. hopefully always. And you describe it as follows later on in the book. You write, when you first met her, I desperately sought order in the narratives I came across. I looked for content related to repressed sexuality or hostility. My eagerness led me to frantically grope for details my informants were holding close to their hearts, partly as secrets and partly as irrepresentable panic. And the more I groped, the more I was shut out, the more frustrated I got, and the more my research suffered. With time, I realized I had to give up on this frantic search for meaning, and that made sense only to me. I had to learn to welcome whatever form of communication I encountered. I had to learn to welcome whatever form of communication I encountered. And you and I had some email exchanges about this because I was confused. I was confused because the understanding of clinical work, of analytic work that you were referring to seemed one that I couldn't quite understand. I didn't know if it was a straw man. I didn't know if it was your experience. I didn't know where it came from, the idea that one listens and rushes to assign meaning as opposed to continuing to listen. And you wrote back something to me which helped me understand our different positions. You wrote, this is an excerpt from a much longer letter. You wrote, my intention is in describing this approach was to highlight the importance of staying present with the complexity of the patient's or participant's experience without prematurely imposing interpretations. By contrast, I have observed instances both in literature and clinical discussions where there is a subtle yet discernible pull to resolve ambiguity quickly, often by assigning meaning based on the pre-existing theoretical constructs or assumptions. This urge, which may stem from countertransference or a desire to find coherence, can risk foreclosing the mutual discovery of meaning that emerges in the relational field. And that helped me understand how profound this work has become for you and how it has deepened the experience for you and the patient. And later on in the book, the way you described it, you said, I am witnessing it in a bid to represent it. Mm. I'm witnessing it in a bid to represent it. And when I read that and reread that, it occurred to me, we're back to Lowald. That the representation of it is what he calls turning it into an ancestor, is turning it into secondary process so that it becomes a metaphor, and it becomes the metaphor through your capacity and interest and affection for the person and the process that allows you to witness the special way that you do.
Yeah. You know, in response to what you just said, what's coming to me is recently I came across a quote by Harold Searles. You know, somewhere he says, the worst thing you can do to a patient is not allow them to help you. I think you mentioned it earlier also in our exchange, and I brought it up again today, that if I put it in one sentence, then amongst other things, I learned to honor the immediacy of experience. I realized that the urgency to seek meaning came from my own discomfort with uncertainty, with not being okay with being confused, and not being okay with sitting with ambiguity. I also learned to appreciate that some states will not easily enter words because they would not enter thought. They would not be represented. So to remain open to alternate ways of expression, such as enactments, art, fragmented speech, was another learning. To appreciate that, you know, as recently in a seminar, Adam Phillips was saying that the analysis begins where words end. And that felt very relatable. That felt very, very true. In other words, I became curious when a client hits an I don't know moment. I feel it is where knowing has ended that we can finally enter and connect with something unconscious. So I learned that transformation does not always look like resolution. Though this was not a clinical setting, the space we co-created allowed something unthinkable to become culturally thinkable. And healing, I realized, is not about answers, but it's about learning to hold that something that was unbearable, and about helping the other person become more curious about their mind. So cure is in curiosity.
Which can only, certainly with individuals like this, can only take place in the presence of another mind,
a
benevolent mind, who is introducing you and sharing that state of curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel that's all that can be all some person needs. I've also recently, like you read about countertransference, and you read about what I learned from her, and I'm also reflecting on it. I think deep down, we all of us have a need to have an object that's not opaque, someone I can impact, someone on whom I can see my impact. I feel that was also something that gained, and I see that unfolding in my clinical work now.
Well, recognizing that, to attempt a summary of your work with her and your own growing, and all of our growing openness as clinicians, let me ask you to do the impossible and to summarize it by reading on page 253.
To do the impossible, yes. Perhaps the ghosts that haunt are the parts of us that long for such freeing love, parts that long to belong to the haunted. A ghost story then is also a love story. Possession states are feeble, misdirected, nightmarish attempts to connect with the emptiness in place of which the possession serves a partial function. If possessing forces can be brought in contact with benevolent processes, a transformation of those forces into something akin to love can be accomplished. This is where beauty in brokenness appears. In retrospect, I realize this work has been facilitated by the spirit of psychoanalysis that is guided by Freud's conviction that it is essentially through love that healing happens.
Shani, all I can do is say thank you. It has been a pleasure to immerse myself in what felt initially quite foreign, and your presence and your thoughtfulness and your immersion into what was foreign to you allowed me, it served as the medium which allowed me and other readers to immerse themselves in your work and in the minds and lives of the people you spent all this time with. So I'm grateful.
Thank you so much, Harvey. Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.